I'm sorry? It's 42 pages, I think. Yeah. It's a good number. All right. And then, of course, we also have books, too. Besides the magazine, we have books. In fact, I'm selling the books back there. And I'll take cash, check, or credit card. Yeah, Chesterton's parents were quite educated, and he was actually raised as a Unitarian. And he went to a very good preparatory school, St. Paul's School in London, the same school that John Milton attended. And the headmaster told his parents, don't send him to college. We haven't been able to teach him anything. So he didn't go to the university. Thank God. Yes. Yeah, you, yes. Yes, distributism. Chesterton's social economic ideas are based on the social teachings of the Catholic Church, primarily Pope Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum. And that's where the term distributism comes from, where Pope Leo says that justice must be distributive. Justice is for everybody. And the basic idea is that the Pope saw this, where the modern world is going, that big money capital, industrial capitalism had basically created communism because communism was a reaction against it. And while he was writing against communism, he realized that what has been lost is small ownership. And big money capitalism destroyed small ownership because all the capital came into the hands of just a few. And the majority of the population had become wage slaves and had lost their own productivity and their own self-sufficiency and had lost the whole concept of ownership. But distributism is an economy based on the family. And so it's the emphasis is on small ownership and independence. And so you local economies and local control rather than massive central control and global economies. And there's a lot more interest in distributism now than just a few years ago, particularly with the recent economic collapse. And there are books coming out on distributism. I have a chapter on distributism in each of the books that I've written. And Chester kind of sets up the problem, why it's needed in What's Wrong with the World, and then he explains distributism as a solution in his book called The Outline of Sanity. There's a lot more on distributism on our website, too. And we always have an article on distributism in our magazine, too. So there was another question back there. Yes. Well, it's interesting. The writers that he admired were Charles Dickens, Shakespeare, Walt Whitman. Why Walt Whitman, you ask? Well, I'll answer that. This was during the 1890s when there was this great cynical decadence. And when he read Walt Whitman, he saw someone who loved life. And that was totally counter to the prevailing mood in England at the time. And there was this pioneer spirit in Walt Whitman that he liked, but just the joy of existence and the appreciation of every flower. And that for Chesterton was a very moving and a big turning point in his life when he just embraced that idea. So we're talking about literary figures. The writers he admired were all literary figures. He didn't read any theologians. He didn't read any of the great defenders of the faith, although he did have a familiarity with Newman. Yes. Movies based on his writings? Yeah, well, we did a production of one of his plays at EWTN. There's a DVD of that called The Surprise. It was a play that he wrote but was never performed in his lifetime. And we did the world premiere on TV of it. And it's really very clever and witty. It's a lovely play. The Father Brown stories, some of them have been produced on television. And one, Alec Guinness starred in a Father Brown movie in the 1950s that actually played a role in his own conversion to Catholicism. But the short answer to your question is there have been no movies based on any of his novels. However, I just produced one. And when I say I just produced it, I've almost finished producing it because it's in post-production and it's almost ready to be released. But it's based on Man Alive, which is one of his lesser-known novels and a delightful, life-affirming story. So pray that that comes out pretty soon because I want to see it. My connection to EWTN is that I have a television show that's on Sunday nights called The Apostle of Common Sense, and I've been doing that show for about 10 years. And I don't I live in Minneapolis, and I go down there about once every 18 months or so and tape 13 new episodes. And the show is broadcast all over the world. It has quite a bit of exposure, and it's really done a lot to bring back an interest in G.K. Chesterton. Yes, sister. Yes, interesting enough, Chesterton didn't become Catholic till he was 48 years old. He was it was a very slow, methodical, and well, one of those conversions that took a long time. Okay, and yet he always had a devotion to Our Lady. He was writing poems about the Virgin Mary long before his conversion. He wrote a poem called The Beatific Vision when he was very young. And when he writes about Our Lady, it's usually in poetry. There's very few prose pieces about her. Just a few essays in some of his later more Catholic books. But generally, it's one of the few topics he writes very little about in prose, but a lot in poetry. And of course, one of the best poetic treatments of her comes in his Ballad of the White Horse, the vision that King Alfred has of the Blessed Virgin Mother. But all of these things reflect this lifelong devotion that he had to her. And when he writes about his conversion, it's one of the things about Protestantism that he never quite understood is why there was this dislike and almost repulsion towards Mary, because he says that was never present for me. And and I'm an evangelical convert to Catholicism, and the devotion to Mary was one of the hardest things for me because it was so foreign to my experience growing up as a Baptist. It was really a difficult thing to grasp, but for Chesterton it was just a natural for him. And I think it was just because he was truly a mystic. I think he had just such deep spiritual thoughts that he connected with her early on. And anyone who is any kind of a mystic has a devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary. There are no mystics who don't have a connection to her. And so it's very interesting. I think one of the most lovely images in any of his poems about Mary is in a poem called A Little Litany, where he describes the Christ child on Mary's lap crawling up and looking in her eyes. And I've got goosebumps right now, okay? Because he said, "And God looked upon God in the reflection in her eyes." Yes. Yeah, I've read it, and I think, you know, some of his criticisms were legitimate, but I disagree with the major thesis of his book. But interesting enough, his new book called The Church and the Libertarian is right on, and it's a great book. And Christopher and I met each other this last summer and had some wonderful discussions, and he was a little bit worried about meeting me, knowing that he'd written this book against EWTN. But I said, don't worry, I wasn't mentioned in the book, so... Yes, I the first time I ever was in England about 8 years ago, I visited a place. It was actually in Oxford, where they have a wonderful collection of Chesterton's books that he owned himself, and some of the artifacts related to his life, including the typewriter of his secretary that was used to type The Everlasting Man and the St. Thomas Aquinas book, and of course lots of his original samples of his writings and his toy theater pieces all of his drawings and things like that. But there his hat, I got to put on his hat and put on the little pince-nez, you know, the pinch on the end of the nose there that he was always adjusting. But then they said, here's Chesterton's rosary. I said, oh. And I had, at that moment, it just occurred to me, I've never read anything where Chesterton actually refers to, you know, praying the rosary. And I said, well, of course. You know, he always had this devotion to Mary, so here's his rosary. It was a very masculine, manly rosary, big black beads. And I said, well, there were about six of us in the room. I said, well, let's pray a decade right now. And I got to tell the beads. And we chose the Nativity of Our Lord as the decade that we prayed together. And I'm trying to think, it was interesting because I was, at the time, my father was dying. And I prayed specifically that I'd be able to see him again before he died, because I had this long trip to England. And he'd actually been unconscious for about 3 days before I got home, and just sprang to life when I got home, and we spent 10 days together. So, great. Yes. Chesterton and his wife actually had no children. No, they wanted children. They were very, very much hoping that they would have lots of children. And Frances, his wife, had some sort of a physical problem and was unable to bear any children. And so when they, after visiting several doctors, realized that they were not going to have any children, they made the decision at that point to just fill their house with other people's children. And so they had the equivalent of foster children that just lived with them for extended periods of time. And he loved the chaos of children around him. He wanted them around. And you know, he was not this guy who retreated into his study to write quietly. I mean, that was the most unnatural way he wrote, was quietly in his study. Usually it was in a railroad station or at a pub. There's a famous story of him standing in a bakery in the morning, reading a poem that he just had written out loud while people are going in and out. And it was just a daily occurrence in the small town where he lived. Yeah. Great story, too, of the small town where he lived, because a man of his stature would have normally had a barber come to visit him to cut his hair. But he purposely wanted to go to the corner barber shop to talk to the men, to find out what they were thinking, what their concerns, how they felt about the issues of the day. He wanted to be one of the common men. He truly thought he was, but you know, he wasn't, because he was on this plane up here. But this is his way of mixing with them, and so he'd always go there once a week to you know, get the cleanup done. And one Saturday he gets there, and there's a little boy standing in line waiting to get his hair cut, and Chesterton's in a hurry, so he gives the little boy a coin. He says, you know, can I go in front of you in line? Oh, yes, Mr. Chesterton. Well, the next Saturday there were two little boys standing there. And then the next Saturday there were a whole line of little boys. And that became a weekly ritual, that they knew when Chesterton was going to come and get his haircut, they'd line up. And he'd give each of them a tip to him. Yeah. Yes, Father. Well, he and Shaw had a great mutual respect for each other and really a warm admiration for each other. And it's typical of Chesterton that he really had no enemies. Even the people he absolutely disagreed with on a philosophical basis could not help but love him because he never attacked them personally. He only went after their ideas, and he was so personally charming and amicable and loving. It was clear that he only argued with them because he really wanted them to change their minds, because he thought they'd be happier if they changed their minds, not because he was trying to score any debating points. You know, the whole idea of arguing with somebody is not to belittle them, but to convert them. We don't want to crush our enemies. We want to bring them over to our side. That's what Chesterton was really trying to do. And even when his philosophical opponents would get angry at the fact that they were losing the argument, they couldn't get angry at Chesterton himself. And they had... Shaw himself said the world is not thankful enough for G.K. Chesterton. That's pretty high praise. And H.G. Wells, another writer whose ideas are 180 degrees different from Chesterton, yet they were friends. And H.G. Wells came to Chesterton's funeral and said to Francis Chesterton, "If there's a chance of me going to heaven, it's because I knew G.K. Chesterton." Yes. Yeah, he debated Clarence Darrow in New York about, it was 6 years after the Scopes trial. And everybody knows about the Scopes trial and how Clarence Darrow won that debate at the Scopes trial, but no one knows about when Chesterton beat Clarence Darrow in a debate in New York City in 1931. And just really beat him badly, too. Everybody was worried because of Darrow's great reputation as this debater, and they were worried that this meek and gentlemanly Englishman was going to come in and be humiliated, and it was Darrow that was humiliated. And unfortunately, there's no transcript of the debate, but we recreated it on one of our EWTN shows using eyewitness accounts and then samples from their writings. But Darrow did look like an absolute fool that night, because he was an absolute fool. Yes. Chesterton and Belloc, here's really interesting. I mean, they were truly great friends, and yet they were totally different. Chesterton says, it just so happens that we agree on politics and religion. And that really is all they had in common. They totally agreed on politics and religion, which is rare in this world. But they were utterly different in their personalities, in their general approach, certainly in their writing styles and their debating techniques. Belloc was this curmudgeon and sort of a tragic figure. His wife dies at a young age. He's left to raise five children on his own. He loses a son in World War I, another son in World War II. And it was a man who was just this brilliant academic mind who should have become a professor at Oxford, because he was the top of his class at Oxford, but he didn't get the appointment because he was Catholic. And so he always had to struggle and just scratch and claw to make a living as a writer. Whereas Chesterton was this easygoing, charitable, likable, avuncular guy who just could pour out the writing easily and, you know, made a decent living as a writer and never had to worry to support a family the way Belloc had to do it. And so, yet they totally were always defending each other and always watching each other's back. And it's a beautiful friendship. And what's really interesting, too, is that Belloc, in that period, was really the only cradle Catholic of any intellectual note. All the other great intellectual Catholics were converts. Yeah. Yes. I'm sorry? Oh, yeah, yeah. Lots of his poems are put to music. There's several versions of some of his Christmas poems and of his famous poem, The Donkey. It's just that none of them are any poems, any songs that you've probably heard. But there was real... The most famous one is O God of Earth and Altar, the hymn. Does anybody know that hymn, O God of Earth and Altar? Yeah. Anyways, that's probably his most famous poem that's been put to music. It's a hymn, and there's even a rock and roll group that recorded that one. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely completely different from socialism. People who say it's something like socialism are simply the people who are trying to defend capitalism. You know, and Chesterton's argument against capitalism is this. It's not that there are too many capitalists, but there's too few. There's too few people who control the capital. And capitalism works if there's more people who have capital. But socialism is against ownership. It's against the independence of the family to actually own and run their own business and to control their own means of production. And so it's utterly different from socialism. And the only people who ever call it socialism are people who are simply defending big money capitalism or who don't know what they're talking about. But I always am amused by people who dismiss distributism as socialism. The Catholic Church condemns socialism. The Catholic Church supports distributism. It's that simple. Distributism is the acting out of Catholic social teaching, which is justice for the poor. I mean, in a nutshell, Catholic social teaching is justice for the poor. That's what it is. Chesterton says the opposite of employment is not unemployment. The opposite of employment is independence. That's the kind of economy in a society he's trying to strive for. That people actually own their own property. That's not socialism. Good enough answer? Okay. What brought me to Chesterton? Yes, well, I was, as an evangelical, I was a big C.S. Lewis fan. And I was reading a C.S. Lewis book one day, and someone saw me reading it and said, well, do you like C.S. Lewis? I said, yeah, I love C.S. Lewis. Have you ever read G.K. Chesterton? I said, I've never heard of G.K. Chesterton. And he said, you know, if you read Chesterton, I mean, if you like C.S. Lewis, you'll really love Chesterton. Then he said, in fact, if you read Chesterton, you won't even need to read C.S. Lewis. Because all of C.S. Lewis is in Chesterton. And I, of course, I thought that was a blasphemous comment, you know. But then I finally picked up, that comment kind of stuck with me. I said, you know, note to self, read Chesterton. And I finally picked up my first Chesterton book on my honeymoon. So I've been married to Chesterton as long as I've been married to my wife. It was The Everlasting Man, yeah. And she was reading Les Miserables on her honeymoon, so. Yeah, it's a good story. Did you have a question, Father? Sure, thank you. The Chesterton Society, you know, just exists to promote an interest in Chesterton because this important writer needs to be rediscovered. He's so much the writer for our time right now. The cure for what ails us, both in terms of our faith and in terms of the societal structure that we need. And so as a Chesterton Society, we do encourage local groups to get together and read his books, but we have our magazine, we have a very active website that's going to become more active in about another month here. I go around the country giving talks, not unlike the one you've just heard. And I was telling you, tomorrow night I speak at Steubenville, and the next day I speak at the University of Notre Dame. So, you know, the whole gamut here, right? And the other thing is we're trying to repackage Chesterton for a new generation. So the television shows are part of that. We've produced this movie now. We're trying to get that name out there so that people think, oh, okay, what did Chesterton say about that? You know, when they start asking that question, you know, then we've got them. And one of the, as a literary society, we're trying to collect all his writings, which still hasn't been accomplished, and digitize it so that they'll be easily accessible. But we have just a huge collection of his writings. His 100 books only represent a fraction of what he wrote. That's what's so astonishing. Yeah. Yes, sister. Yeah, if you wanted to write 5,000 essays, you'd have to write one a day without taking Sundays off for the next 15 years. Yeah. And then you can, after that, as I say, you can write your St. Thomas Aquinas book then after that. So, keep me in your prayers. God bless you all. Thank you. Thank you.